Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Books We Read. I'm Reagan Schrock, and I'm here with Jaron Miller, and it has been a minute, for sure, since we have done one of these, and it's good to do them again. Today, we have an interesting episode where Jaron's going to review a book that I attempted to read but couldn't make it through, so that'll be interesting, and then I have another one to share that's not terribly related, but somewhat. So my book is called The Virtues of War. It's a novel about Alexander the Great, which is an interesting topic. Jaron, what is the book that you're bringing this episode?
Moby Dick by Herman Melville.
Yeah, so Moby Dick is one of those that's, you know, a great piece of literature and you're supposed to read it and all of these things. And so I attempted to. I think around the same time you did, and I didn't realize this until after the fact. So, how did it go for you?
It was a really good experience. I love the book, and I'm glad that I read it.
That's interesting, because I made it to about page 37, and was like, I can't handle this anymore. So I put it back on the shelf. I can't understand how it became a classic. So
what
may,
happened?
You may need to persuade me.
So I'm curious what happened for you at page 37 and why couldn't you make it to the end?
So for those that have not held a copy of this book, it's like, what, 800 pages or something? It's very substantial. I guess it depends on your font.
Sounds about
size.
Right.
Yeah, like mine had a little larger font, so maybe it was more like 900, but it was like, you know, I'm picking up a dictionary here. So I start reading it and I'm expecting this thing to blow my mind and be amazing. And, you know, his use of language is fantastic and it was very descriptive and very eloquent, but it was incredibly boring. Like it took forever to get anywhere. And I was just like, can this story move along now? Or are we just going to be here for a very long time or something? And, I just couldn't hack it. It just, felt like he could have said everything he said in about, you know, a third as many words. So it felt like it should be maybe a 300-page book. You had the patience and perseverance. So please do explain.
He often makes diversions onto things that might seem like bunny trails or things that aren't connected to the actual story. So I'm curious, did you get into any of the points where he did some of those? For example, by page 37, had he made it onto the ship yet, or was he still on land? Because somewhere in there, he just dedicates a whole chapter to recounting a sermon that he heard in a church he stopped at.
Yeah, the sermon at the church was where I really started to get lost. It was just like, here's a whole sermon. Okay, you know, is this relevant? So no, I stopped before he made it onto the ship. Yeah, he was about to board the ship, if I remember right, and that's where I stopped. So
yeah. Well, if you're concerned about the drudgery and the tangential bunny trails, you stopped before it got even worse. The first 37 pages that you made through were the most exciting part of the book. But if you have patience, it's really good. Maybe I should just give a plot summary for those who have not read it. Written from a first-person perspective, Ishmael is the narrator and one of the main characters in the book. He is in Massachusetts looking for a whaling ship to board. I don't think that Melville gives the date that this happened, but if you were whaling in Massachusetts, it was probably sometime in the 18th century or early 19th century. The book was written in 1851, and so I imagine that Melville had a setting in mind a few decades or maybe 100 years prior to when he lived. So Ishmael makes a friend while he's still on shore. I imagine in the pages that you read, Reagan, you met his friend, the headhunting cannibal. I thought it was a funny part, the way their friendship began. And they find a whaling ship run by Quakers, and they go off into the ocean killing whales. So they harpoon several whales along the way, but the captain, whose name is Ahab, is driven by anger and revenge in his quest for a certain white whale that sometime prior had attacked him and bitten off his leg. So out of vengeance and anger, Ahab really, really wants to find this whale. And so they go sailing all over the ocean, looking for the whale. And at the end of the book, they finally find the whale and they try to harpoon it, but the whale gets away. The ship is destroyed. Everybody but Ishmael and the whale die. So that's the basic gist of the book. So I'm not exactly sure how to read this book. When I read the book myself, what I was trying to do was to suspend disbelief and engage with it by feeling the emotions of the characters, feeling the anger of Ahab, accepting it as on his own terms and not try to think about it too critically. Or maybe another way to say it would be to spend more time with the pathos rather than the logos of the book. Which kind of worked. That made it a more enjoyable experience for me, where I just accepted it as authoritative and didn't question it too much. Now, it was hard not to question. I think it's about 3 times too long, and it could have been shorter, and the same thing could have been communicated. But I've actually been questioning that recently. I think it needs to be as long as it is. One of my frustrations with the book, and maybe this is some of what you were getting at, Reagan, like, why was there a chapter dedicated to a sermon? There was a lot of chapters dedicated to a lot of different things that didn't seem to have a whole lot to do with the plot. I'm just looking at the table of contents for an example. Chapter 108 is about Ahab and the carpenter. So if we have a chapter about Ahab, that's definitely on topic. Ahab is one of the main characters. Chapter 109, we have another chapter called Ahab and the Starbuck in the Cabin. Let's see. Chapter 111, we have a chapter called The Pacific, which is probably just a chapter about the ocean. So that could begin to feel a little bit tangential. Chapter 112 is a chapter about the blacksmith. We just have a whole chapter dedicated to blacksmithing. Not really on topic. 113, The Forge. A whole chapter about the forge. 114, The Glider. And that's kind of the gist of it. You have like a little bit of plot here. Then you go off and you talk about blacksmithing or about water. Or there's a whole chapter about ropes. Why do I have to spend a chapter about ropes when I'm reading about a whale? But I think there's a reason for that. I was reading what some other people do with the book, how they interpret it. And some have proposed that the book is an epistemological quest, which I think is interesting. The book is about a hunt for a whale, but what if we read that as a metaphor, as the hunt for knowledge or for truth? Somebody named Lori Robinson Laurent wrote about the book, "Man's search for meaning in a world of deceptive appearances and fatal delusions. Ishmael's taxonomy of whales merely demonstrates the limitations of scientific knowledge and the impossibility of achieving certainty." She also contrasts Ishmael's and Ahab attitudes towards life with Ishmael's open-minded and meditative polypositional stance as antithetical to Ahab's monomania, adhering to dogmatic rigidity. So that's a way of interpreting the book that I never would have arrived at myself after reading through it once. But it makes a lot of sense. So it's an interesting contrast between Ahab, who is so driven by looking for this one specific whale. There's one little whale in a whole ocean of whales, and he focuses on nothing except that one whale. In contrast, Ishmael, the narrator, he's looking for whales, but he's also very distracted and interested in all the different whales. It's what Lori Robertson Laurent called the taxonomy of whales. Like, he's interested in this whale and that whale, and how do you categorize them? But he's also interested in seagulls and ropes, and he's interested in learning all he can about ropes and blacksmithing and everything seemingly off topic, but it's just a very different way of engaging with the world from what Ahab, how Ahab does it. So could we see it as a metaphor? Like, what happens if we have a very, very focused, very precise vision of what we believe about the world or what we want to know or what we're looking for at the expense of everything else? Epistemological myopia. It's not a technical term, but I kind of wonder if that's how we could see Ahab. In contrast to a much more well-rounded and open approach to the world, where we're looking for whales, we're looking for one particular thing, but that doesn't let us prevent us from engaging with other kinds of knowledge and pursuits along the way. So maybe that's one way of understanding the book, in which it is necessary to have all these diversions and rabbit trails, because it's a better picture of how we ought to be pursuing truth.
Is this almost, again, because I haven't read it, does it give the sense that there's almost a little bit of ADHD going on here, where Ishmael is just constantly, oh, look, this thing, oh, look, that thing? Is that at all what's going on here, whereas the captain is single-minded, one thing only, and that's all there is?
That's how it feels to me. But, you know, if we say ADHD, that's often not something we want. But maybe it's a good take on that, or a good adaptation, where being willing to be distracted by the things along the way in life when our quest for truth are actually good.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really interesting. Okay, because of the theory I heard, which I have not looked into this much at all, but back in the day, a lot of these things were serialized and they were paid by the word. And that's why some of those old classic novels are way too long. Is there any truth to that, you think?
I don't know.
It was that one, or like, I think there's some about like Charles Dickens. Some of his stuff was serialized, so it was every whatever weekly paper or something, and that was your chapters. And as long as you could keep it going, was like more money you made or something. So you would just keep writing. I don't know if there's any truth to that in this case, but that was more the vibe I got from reading this book. It was like he was trying to fill pages, but at the same time, it was very brilliantly written, very eloquent. So I will say that. So, man, that's interesting, huh?
Yeah, try reading it again, but appreciate all the rabbit trails. Now, I would struggle with that, but if I do read the book again, I'm gonna try to look at it from that perspective and see if it helps.
That's really interesting though, where it's like appreciate the rabbit trails as actually part of. The value of the book. They're not really as rabbit trails almost. I don't know that. Yeah, that's, yeah. I wouldn't have thought of that.
To stretch the metaphor, maybe the rabbit trails are actually the road that we're supposed to be taken on.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Huh. Still don't think I would make it through, but that's interesting. Man, Jared, your level of patience and perseverance is Herculean. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, anyways, I don't have much more to say about that. So I'm curious about your book.
Yeah, so mine is a pretty different style. But it's still a novel. So I stumbled on Stephen Pressfield. I don't know. Someone recommended some of his nonfiction to me or something. I'm trying to remember. So I've read some of his nonfiction and then found this one at a used bookstore. And I've listened to a couple of his stuff as audiobooks and things. So Stephen Pressfield has written quite a bit about ancient Greece and Sparta and some of the engagements between Persia and Greece and things like that. It's really one of his fields of specialty, I guess you could say, as a novelist. And wow, that's really good. So this one tackles Alexander the Great. It's one of his later. He's written a bunch of stuff before this, but Alexander the Great, and it's called The Virtues of War. So it's written as if Alexander the Great is teaching the things that the principles he lives by to a junior officer. So the book is written in first person from Alexander the Great's perspective, just before he dies. During his campaign in India. And it's very different from Moby Dick in that, well, it's much shorter and it's very precise and honed in. It doesn't feel like anything's wasted. It's like it grabs you and it's there the whole way through is what it felt like to me. I think I read this in like a day or 2 days. It was really, really incredible. And there are certain coming into this novel, I didn't know hardly anything about Alexander the Great, but there are certain individuals in history that just radically changed the world. And, you know, there's these debates, you know, amongst historians, like how much does one individual life actually matter in the grand historical scheme of things? Because the wheels of change are just too big for one person to influence. And I've never quite bought into that. And I think Alexander the Great is a really good example of that. One man, you know, in his 20s, in the span of 10 years, basically conquers the known world at the time. And it's mind-blowing. And it's not the kind of novel that takes a lot of liberties. It's pretty solid historically. It has maps in it and, you know, charting things and, like, explaining in pretty complicated detail of, you know, his battle tactics and how certain things worked and using a lot of original source material and things. It's just brilliantly done. And I came away from that book appreciating how different the world is now because of Alexander the Great. The world would be very different if he hadn't done what he did. I don't know if that's good, bad, indifferent. I don't really know. That's another thing that's debated among historians. But just taking someone from little backwater Macedonia, you know, in the hills, to conquering all of Greece and the entire Persian Empire, which is basically the greatest empire at the time, or one of the greatest empires in the history of the world, really, and conquering the Middle East and making it all the way into India and Pakistan and conquering Afghanistan and doing all of that in 10 years in your 20s is just really hard to get my head around. And what was it like to work with someone like that? So basically the book is a exploration of that question. Like, what was it about Alexander the Great that was so special? Like, I mean, he wasn't an average guy. I mean, you don't just wake up and do that one day. And so it goes into like some of his philosophies of life and how his leadership tactics and things. And obviously there's some liberty there because we don't really know exactly how he did all of this. But really the contrast between the worldview of the Greeks, or the Macedonians, I guess you could say, and the Persians, and how wildly different they are in religion and philosophy and just general lifestyle and government and all of those things. And then the implication is pretty strong. You know, if this hadn't happened, how different would the world be if we grew, you know, came into a world that had more of a Persian mindset versus that Greek style of thinking? What if Greek philosophy had been destroyed by the Persian Empire instead of the other way around? You know, how would things be different? And it's a real question. I ran into how significant this was because, you know, some of the some really well preserved and excellent examples of Greek architecture and art are in Afghanistan, in the middle of absolute nowhere. There's like a Greek amphitheater and mosaics and temples and buildings. And it just shows like how far his influence went. Even after he died, his empire was split up by his, by the four generals under him, you know. And you go to like some of the places I've been in the Middle East, and you know, this heavy, heavy Greek influence, where really it would have been a very, very different story, you know. And the thinking is, if he could have kept his army on his side, because his army basically mutinied on him. How far would if he went? I mean, his goal was the whole world. He was going to continue until he hit the ocean, like the Pacific, like going east. And so they were going through India. They had, you know, they were fighting in the jungles of India with elephants and, you know, with Macedonian troops all the way from Macedonia fighting in the, you know, Himalayas and stuff. Like, it's just insane. So how far would if he went? You know, would have India been another part of the Greek Empire? But eventually his army was like, we're done. You know, we're going back. We want to go home now. It's been 10 years since we were at home, so we quit. And he writes about that, like how he's trying to convince them to keep going and why they should keep going and why conquering the world matters and stuff. It's pretty wild stuff. So ultimately, the book ends there, but ultimately, you know, they do turn around and return home, and he chooses Babylon, close to present day Baghdad now, as the center of his empire. And then he catches a disease. I forget what it was. We don't entirely really know what killed him, but he caught a disease and died at, I don't know, what was it, 32 or something. And then his empire was split up, and a lot of even biblical history is wildly influenced by that. You know, with anyway, it's just some interesting thought experiments and things. So I have come to appreciate how significant of a historical figure he was. And, you know, legendary is definitely the right word to use when you're talking about Alexander the Great. There was something very unique and once in a, you know, however many thousand year, do you have an individual like that? You know, there's a couple people like that in history where one person seems to really change the whole world. And Alexander the Great, you know, Napoleon, Hitler, some of those people are off the top of my head that come to mind, but they're very rare. And I think reading about them and understanding more of what they did and how they thought and what the world was like before and then after them is, I think, pretty important. So yeah, it's a good read. It's a pretty easy read. But it doesn't shortchange you on depth. It really gets deep into, you know, how he did these things. And some of it's speculation, of course. I mean, it is a novel after all. But oh yeah. And also for perspective, Stephen Pressfield wrote another book about the Spartans called Gates of Fire, just before this one. And it was so, well done and accurate and so forth that I think it was the Greek government made him an honorary citizen of Athens, as an example, like he, you know, you've honored our history this much by writing this accurately about us. So I feel like his novels are, you know, he spends years researching them and getting them as close as he can. So anyway, I feel like I learned a lot, and now I want to go read a lot more about, the clash between Greece and Persia back in the day and how that still influences our world. So anyway, that's the synopsis. Did that make any sense? Did I miss anything, Jaren?
No, that makes a lot of sense as an overview of the book. You mentioned his philosophy or his thought processes, how he would talk about it to a junior and how it contrasted with the Persians. I'm curious, what was characteristic of his philosophy or the ideas that motivated him?
You have classic Greek philosophy of more the concepts of democracy and some of those things that are world is, or the Western world, basically the ideals of the Western world, in general, and versus the Persian, especially you see this in military, in battles, the Persians was more, it's a hierarchical system of I'm at the top and you're a subordinate and you need to do what we say. And it's very, just kind of this big plotting machine. There wasn't a lot of mobility, you know, in how things were set up. And that's something he there's a whole section in here when they conquer Babylon, and he's analyzing how the government is set up, and his brain just about can't handle it. He's like, this is insane. How do people live like this? Like the basically serfs are stuck in this certain way of life, and this is ridiculous. Like, they need to have a chance to make money and, you know, build a house if they want to and not be stuck in this certain position for generations, you know, on this farm and whatever. It was pretty nasty situation. So he brings one of them in and they're explaining how it all works. And yeah, we have to give basically everything to the tax man. And, you know, at the end, there's basically enough for food and that's it. And he said, well, that's terrible. We're going to change this. And here, I'll give you some land. I'll give you some money. And the person, the farmer immediately was like, no, don't do that, because you'll upset the system and my neighbors will come kill me because I have more than they do. And he's over here being like, yeah, but the system's so broken, you know, we should have individual, you know, liberty to do what you want and earn a living and, you know, start a business. And it, like, kind of the typical, like, how we would more think, I guess, more as Americans. And they were like, no, that's not how society works. Like, this, and it ends up, he has to leave the system in place because it was so pervasive across the society of, nope, that's your place in the social ladder and you can't move. Some of the things along those lines, you know, it shows in a lot of the battles too, where, you know, they would have, say, 50,000, I think it was around 50,000 in the Alexander the Great's army, and he'll be up against the Persians, who have somewhere around, you know, close to a million, and he would win. Well, why? You know, it was not that top-down structure. He let his subordinates make more decisions, and the way he ran his battles was just so fundamentally different. Whereas the Persians didn't fight that way. And it's just interesting. It's just really, really interesting. Feels a lot more secular, whereas the Persians seemed, you know, more mystic almost, and much older. They had a much, much older empire that kind of had their set ways of doing things, and very, very wealthy. So like when they would come into battle, they'd bring the king's tent, which had like, you know, wooden floors and was so big he could house, you know, I wish I could remember the dimensions of some of like the Persian infrastructure they would bring into the battlefield, whereas Alexander the Great's like sleeping under the stars, you know, or something. Like it's just such a different style of life. Very rugged, you know, very, very rugged style that Alexander the Great preferred. I'm not sure if that feels a bit vague. I wish I could get a little more into some of the underlying philosophies. He doesn't name stuff specifically, but it's more in like how they lived and stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It sounds like a different view of culture, a view of what a human is and what is the human's role in their environment.
Yeah, it was really fun to read it, because I actually, there's that huge decisive battle between, what was it? It would have been Darius. Yeah, Darius and Alexander the Great, where the king of Persia, it's like, all right, I'm tired of you conquering me. They've made it all the way to like northern Iraq at this point. They've rolled all of Turkey and Syria and, you know, Palestine and stuff into the Greek Empire. And so this is this big ultimate showdown between the Persian king and Alexander the Great. And it's considered one of the biggest and most decisive battles in the history of the world. It happened on a plane in northern Iraq, and I was on that plane. I have been to that battlefield, and it's huge battlefield. I mean, just massive. And we were talking to one of the guys there. It's just farmland now. And it's between like down in the valley, there's mountains, and then this massive plain. And you're looking at, okay, here's Alexander the Great with 50,000 guys, and here's the king of Persia with almost a million. You know, it seems like a no-brainer on an open playing field like that. But he just devastated their army and won. And the farmer, or one of the guys there, was saying, yeah, as they till the fields, they still are digging up like old swords and relics from that battle, which is pretty wild. I wish I could have seen some of them. But, yeah, it was over 2,000 years ago. It was like 2,300 years, 2,400 years ago. So anyway, it was kind of neat to put some context on that. So anyways, that's the book. Yep. So yeah, did you have anything else you wanted to add to this episode? I think that's what we've got so far. So.
No, nothing else.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening to this episode. But yeah, that was interesting, Jaren. I'll never look at Moby Dick quite the same way again. So that was helpful and interesting. And yeah, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Reagan Schrock and Jaren's at Jaren Miller. And I think we both have websites. I have a newsletter, things like that. So you can check us out on the internet if you want to learn more about what we're doing here. So, also the Books We Read podcast has a website now, which is kind of cool. And it lists like all the books we've reviewed. So if you're ever curious, like what all we've covered here, you should be able to see it all there. So anyway, thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.